I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order.
Likewise, I will call the House Interim Committee on Healthcare to order.
We're going to start out with a shared agenda, and then the Senate will be moving to Hearing Room D after we hear about Cover Oregon and the update on the coordinated care. But I do want to welcome Senator Betsy Close to the committee. She and I served in the House together a long time ago, and I would like us to just welcome her. Should we go ahead?
Go ahead, let's go.
All right, let's call up Bruce Goldberg to report to us on coordinated care organizations.
Good morning. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, here to update you on what's been 9 months of pretty amazing work throughout Oregon that you all have started. And when I go around the state these days, I see a state that really is optimistic and engaged in developing and setting forth its own future around healthcare. Most of the rest of the nation, in many ways, has been in the doldrums about healthcare, concerned about rising costs, concerned about access, quality issues, uncertain about the future. And here in Oregon, what I've been seeing is an amazing engagement and effort in communities to really create their own futures. It all began over the last 2 years with two bills that were passed by you as a legislature with bipartisan support. Last one signed in the beginning of March. And since that time, we've seen an incredible amount of work throughout communities in Oregon to respond to the call to change how care is delivered in Medicaid. We've got new partnerships, a lot of new ideas, a tremendous amount of enthusiasm, and lots and lots and lots of work by an enormous spectrum of people across the state. We have submitted a waiver to the feds to change how our health care is delivered. That was approved in July. We entered into a large procurement, over a $1 billion procurement for this new CCO delivery system, issued RFPs, and awarded our first contracts within 4 months. So anyone that says government can't move quickly, we did. Contracts were finalized, and the first CCOs were operational within 5 months of the bill signing. We've had a rules advisory committee. Rules are in place. We've transitioned about three-quarters of the fee-for-service population into our new CCOs. We've established quality metrics, and we've begun to reorganize the agency to really mimic what's going on out in the community. Engaged right now in a large process to revamp the mental health rules so we can ensure that work out into the community on integrating physical and mental health is a success. And all that with just a reminder that the first CCOs have been operational for 133 days. So when people ask me questions about how things are going, I really remind them that we're in our infancy, and some of our new CCOs were just born. The youngest CCO in the state is 41 days old. We have 15 CCOs up and operational in the state, covering just about every geographic area in the state. We have successfully transitioned 90% of the Medicaid population is now receiving their care through these new coordinated care organizations. You have, you know, before you a list of the 15 organizations. They came on in three waves. 8 came on in August, 5 came on in September, and 3 came on in November. We've transitioned 600,000 OHP members into the new CCOs. It's happened relatively seamlessly. We've worked hard on special mail notices, customer service lines, working with providers and clients. We've transitioned our MMIS system, and things have gone forward pretty smoothly for a transition, one, that large, and two, that quickly. So let me give you a couple of examples of what's going on around the state and what makes me really optimistic around what's happening here in Oregon. I want to tell you the story about Grants Pass and Richard Lewis, who is a social worker. He works out in the community in Grants Pass. And they've put together a team of individuals to respond to high needs patients in their community. There was a woman who they had identified who'd been to the emergency department 3 to 4 times over the course of a month. Mr. Lewis worked with this individual, identified the fact that there were a number of untreated mental health problems, housing issues, a variety of community service issues that were causing her to get help in the emergency department at huge expense and, quite frankly, not really solving what were her problems. They engaged. Months later, this woman is getting the mental health care she needs. She's in stable, affordable housing. She hasn't been to the emergency department. And that really is transforming how care's being delivered. There are successes and innovations all across the state. Now, I've given you a list of, there's probably about 12, 13, 14 things. And this is just really the tip of the iceberg. But we're, as I indicated, 133 days into this. At one extreme and 41 days at another. And yet, everywhere in the state, there's a tremendous amount of change going on in terms of improving quality, lowering cost, that really gives me a tremendous amount of optimism. In Southern Oregon, I just gave you the example from AllCare, partnering with local hospitals to reduce emergency room utilization by getting people hooked into primary care, mental health, et cetera. They've made a commitment to get every one of their members into a patient-centered primary care home within a year. They already have half of their members enrolled in certified patient-centered primary care homes. In Bend, they're developing a way to take care of the most complex and difficult patients on the Oregon Health Plan and establishing a model clinic that really is set up to take care of patients with the most complex needs. They're partnering with a number of community partners and building a specialized clinic to help people manage complex health needs. Why is that important? 20% of the population accounts for about 80% of the healthcare cost, as well as the human toll of illness. And what that community is doing is really focusing on that 20% and building the kind of specialized systems that are going to improve the care for them. In Metro Portland, HealthShare of Oregon is hiring 25 to 30 community outreach workers to help manage the most acute and chronic individuals out in the community, begun hiring those. In Josephine County, Primary Health is identifying key opportunities to focus on the health of their community. Trillium Health Plan has done something pretty remarkable.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask a question? Back with the community health workers, in the development of the bill, there was a lot of discussion about how they would be trained and certified. How's that shaking out in terms of...
Chair Mona Sanderson, Rep. Greenlick, members of the committee, we have a advisory committee that's just been established, which is helping put together with us the rules and the training for these community health workers. We're working with community colleges and other partners to begin developing the curriculum for the community health worker training, as well as how we will, in essence, assure that the training's happening, certify, and have these individuals out in the community. So we've begun that process, hope to have the rules and the curriculums established within the next 6 months, and the training moving to full scale within about a year. You know, and I guess I would add to that, that this will really evolve. I think much as we've seen the number of traditional healthcare workers change pretty dramatically, there's probably many new specialties and many new types of providers of healthcare than when I went to medical school 30 years ago. I don't think we know yet what we're going to see in the community-based healthcare workforce between community health workers, peer wellness specialists, and my sense is that this will evolve, but we're off to a start.
Yes, the follow-up question is the SEIU been involved in some of this?
Yes, they have been a member on the committee and involved in those discussions.
Thank you.
Trillium Health Plan has done something pretty remarkable. They've started to invest $10 per member per year from its global budget into the county public health department, to partner with the county public health department to really set up a community-wide tobacco prevention program that will benefit not just Oregon Health Plan recipients, but the entire county. On the South Coast, the Western Oregon Advanced Health has set up a program to address the needs of foster kids. In the Gorge, they're working on health information technology solutions to help the providers in that community begin to share health information. Columbia Pacific is developing a core set of priorities that will be incorporated into their transformation plans. The Willamette Valley Community Health has hired non-traditional health workers to work with patients, again, with histories of high utilization. Family Care is using collaborative meetings to bring together providers from various disciplines to develop pilot projects to better coordinate and integrate primary health care and mental health care. In short, in every community, in what's been a couple of months of needing to establish new organizations, contract with providers, get businesses set up, all the sorts of nuts and bolts of just establishing a new business, these organizations are beginning to make, from our vantage point, tremendous progress in changing how care is delivered. We have set up the metrics that which we're going to follow progress of our transformation with. We've had a metrics and scoring committee that was established in statute, 9 members. They've been meeting. They have finalized the metrics for financial incentives and monitoring. They've been based on a set of principles, which have been number one, Are these metrics, and this has been the hardest one for them to get to, are these metrics that will really help transform how care is being delivered, consumer engagement, attainability, accuracy, the feasibility of measurement? They've paid a lot of attention to not spending a lot of resources in collecting data, but picking measures that use available data so that we're not creating new and complex information systems. And they've done a great job. They've established 17 metrics in seven areas that are about addressing chronic health conditions, reducing preventable and costly healthcare utilization, integrating physical and behavioral health, improving access to effective and timely care. There are some metrics about perinatal and maternity care. We deliver about half the babies in the state are delivered through the Oregon Health Plan, so that's a big focus. Reducing preventable hospitalizations and improving primary care. These metrics in the first year will be establishing baselines, and then beginning a year from now, 2% of the global budget will be dedicated towards payment towards performance on these metrics. So this isn't just about developing metrics and reporting on them. There's clear financial incentives for CCOs to perform and, quite frankly, gain, have some financial gain by meeting those metrics. These will be transparent. The metrics will be posted quarterly as we begin to get data so that people around the state can follow progress. Likewise, we'll be posting financial performance. There'll therefore be an ability for anybody to compare CCO performance. And the last thing that we'll be working on are the transformation plans, which we'll be posting on our website. So let me just spend a couple of minutes talking about what's next. One is that CCOs have been asked to develop, not asked, it's part of the contract, to develop transformation plans. These are due in January. They'll be finalized in March. They'll be available publicly for people to look at. And this really sets out the CCO's roadmap for how they will transform and change care in their community. At the same time, CCOs are establishing their community advisory councils. During the summer, those community advisory councils will be putting together community health needs assessment and community health improvement plans. It's our hope that we will, over the course of the year, look to streamline and amalgamate what have been health improvement plans being done from the public health perspective by local public health departments, as well as those done by local mental health authorities, and roll those into one broad community health improvement plan. So with all that optimism, I want to temper that with the fact that we're also working on some challenges. As I indicated, 133 days into this, we certainly haven't achieved perfection, but we've begun some great work. We've got some current challenges ahead. Let me go through some of the short-term challenges. Obviously, the long-term challenge is the fundamental transformation of our healthcare delivery system. But in the short term, I think, as you are aware, we've had some challenges and some discussions in integrating dental care into our CCOs. There have been many that feel it's happening too slowly. Many of our CCOs have been ready to integrate dental care last month and had been working with dental providers in their community. Many of our DCO organizations have felt that we needed to take a little bit more time to assure sort of a smooth transition. There's been I would say, some question as to exactly what legislative intent was, whether we were looking to integrate dental care right now in 2014 or some point further in the future. We've had some challenges of our rulemaking process. We've had some hearings. We've taken a lot of public testimony. There's been a lot of interest in this, and we'll be in the next couple of months coming out with some guidance, and that'll be about the same time that you as a legislature will be coming into session, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of discussion about what was the appropriate legislative intent, and if we don't get it right, my sense is you'll let us know, and we'll move that forward. But there's been a lot of discussion about that, and it's certainly been controversial. Another issue has been the inclusion or lack thereof of another number of alternative healthcare providers around the state: naturopaths, chiropractors, midwives, acupuncturists, and many others. We've been working very closely with the CCOs from a number of perspectives on this issue. First and foremost, this is really an opportunity for any providers of care that provide high quality, cost effective care to come into the fold of a CCO. And hopefully that's what CCOs are looking for. It's different in every community. Every community has a different array of providers. We've been encouraging and working with CCOs to include a broad array of providers in their networks. CCOs need to assure that they're meeting client needs and that clients have some choice. By the same token, that doesn't mean that CCOs have to contract with every single provider in their community. They don't do that for traditional healthcare providers, all MDs, or all of any type of provider, but they need to provide some access and some choice. And we're working with them to assure that they do that. Some of them already are working with a number of different alternative healthcare providers, and individuals are getting those services. There was also some concern that there were a lot of individuals in the fee-for-service population who were getting a lot of their care from alternative and healthcare providers, and there was a concern that those relationships would be disrupted. I can assure you that we're working to maintain continuity of care. As we have transitioned people on fee-for-service into CCOs, we have looked at those individuals. There are a couple of hundred individuals who, based on our claims data, have been getting regular ongoing care from a number of alternative providers. Haven't moved those individuals into CCOs yet. We're working with them individually and moving them in as we can be assured that there's a plan to maintain continuity of care and that their care will be maintained. So we're working very carefully around that.
One frustration I am having in talking with various providers is there are healthcare providers that they don't, in my eyes, they don't really have respect for the training or the healthcare delivery to the patients. Yet when you talk to the patients, they are better. They're not on meds. They actually go to a provider that can take care of them without meds. And there are a number of examples here. So I don't know if this is going to be an ongoing problem. I mean, I know it's market share. I know it's just a culture of how we view alternative ways of giving health care. But I'm getting a lot of concerns and angst about this from a variety of people.
Chair Mona Sanderson, we've been hearing the same things, and I would agree with you that, much of this is cultural, and part of what we're doing, not just around this issue, but in terms of the entire healthcare system, is really fundamentally transforming it, changing the culture. That is going to take some time. We're working on that. I'll give you some examples. I met with some acupuncturists the other day who we talked about this very issue. They prepared a variety of packets of information that I'm going to be disseminating to all of the CCOs. And it's actually information about the services they provide, how it's been used, examples of how they've been working with Medicaid clients to exactly address that kind of a cultural issue. I think that we've got opportunities in the future to bring together different groups of providers with CCOs to work on that. Representative Thompson's leaving, but I was going to mention a conversation I had with him about the other day about pharmacists. And same thing, involving pharmacists more in care. We're going to get together a group of pharmacists with CCOs to talk about opportunities to better integrate care and utilize pharmacists. We've got a lot of resources. I don't want to in any way dismiss that there are issues and problems out there, but I do think that we can begin to work through some of that. And I think the last thing we have is we have established a process to assure that providers aren't being discriminated against. We've got that process established, the rules established, it's posted on the web. And we will, and we've been clear, we'll enforce that. And as complaints come in, we will address those and follow the process. We've had our first complaint, and we'll be working our way through that. So I think we need to give this a little bit of time. I think that we're in issues like this, what's really happening is somewhere in the middle. I mean, we know, for instance, that many of our CCOs are already and have been, when some of them have gone from being managed care organizations to reconfiguring themselves, we're actually working with a variety of chiropractors, naturopaths, and acupuncturists as part of the care they were providing. We've been putting together some data and information about those, the claims that we've gotten for that, the healthcare claims, so we're working through it.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
This is a more general than specific, but one of my concerns, and we talked a little bit about this the other day, has been that as we transition from a managed capitated healthcare system, we have lots of examples that have popped up where we're actually only seeing maybe half of the covered lives in, and those are the people that call for appointments. The ones that don't call for an appointment don't see the doctor. It seems as we transition to preventative health care for this population initially, we really need to see all of the patients for no other reason than to have baselines, so we can identify conditions that might be developing before they get expensive. Is there any metric where we're going to be able to look at this in 6 months or a year and say, out of X number of covered lives, we've actually seen some known percentage of these people, so we can measure whether we're moving toward 100%? And of course, that begs the other question, do we have primary care health care providers to see 100% of the population, or do we need to be talking about health care extenders and scopes of practice up front and personal on this stuff to make sure we can see 100% of the covered lives?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Rep. Thompson, members of the committee, we have a number of metrics that we'll be measuring that actually we're incenting, part of those 17 incentive metrics that get at that. Certainly around prenatal care, the number of live of people who receive prenatal care in the first trimester, that's certainly an access issue. The number of clients enrolled in patient-centered primary care homes. There are some access measures to access to care, the number of people that are being seen, and some measures on preventive services. So we are looking at that and measuring that, and we'll be reporting on that. I think at the same time, though, you got at a different piece of that, which is that as we bring more people into care, do we have the right workforce for doing that? And I was just mentioning the conversation you and I had the other day about ways we need to reach out and engage more of the healthcare workforce, such as pharmacists in the delivery of care, which frees up primary care providers to do other things. Certainly alternative providers, community health workers. We can not only, I think, do we need the quantity of some more healthcare workers, but at the same time, if we change how care is delivered, if we prevent a child who's got asthma from going to the emergency room or being in the doctor's office because we take the things out of their house that cause them to wheeze, we free up capacity. And so I think that's part of what we're working on and we're measuring. And I think we'll hopefully see changes in that as we move forward.
It's been my experience that some of these people in the covered classes, they just don't avail themselves of health care until they have a very, very serious problem.
Yeah.
If we're really going to make the preventative side of this work and transformation, we're going to have to reach a point where we're seeing all of the covered patients and starting a baseline file on them. Then how often we see them in the future may be indicated by what we found in the initial assessments. But not assessing these people and keeping them on the rolls as a covered life in my practice isn't health care. It's only coverage. But coverage is only good if we're actually seeing the people and making a measurable difference in their life where needed. And I'm still a little concerned that we've gone from an area of a lot of people being covered and those coverages assigned to particular practices, but they're not actually and have not actually been seen until they're a disaster, and then they're very expensive. We didn't save a dime.
I think that's hopefully what these CCOs will be working on, is exactly that.
I will probably keep asking you for that number, so.
and we'll get it for you.
Eventually I will go away and you won't have to deal with me.
But then you also have to remember, we have to be looking at the patients that are costing us the most money, and 10% of our population is, you know, 90% of our cost share, and so if we can get certain things under control first.
I agree with you, but how many of the patients that are costing us a lot of money would not have cost us that much if we had actually seen them earlier in their disease state?
I hear what you're
and,
saying. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two questions, if I could. Dr. Goldberg, thank you so much. I really appreciate the work of you, your staff, and particularly
Thanks.
The governor's leadership on this. Going to the metrics and the quality pool, can you tell me the official name of that committee so that I can try to track it and how the public can receive notice? If you don't have this information off the top of your head, that's fine, but what the official name of the committee is and how the public can engage with that committee and just kind of see how the decisions are being made, that would be the first question. And then the second is, you know, there are a number of federal initiatives on enhancing primary care. I was hoping you could talk to me about how some of those Medicaid and Medicare enhancement projects are playing out on the ground.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, members of the committee. Senator, the committee is the Metrics and Scoring Committee. It is posted, they're up on our website, www.health.oregon.gov. There's a tab for the Metrics and Scoring Committee. Their meetings are public, they're posted, and their work is out there, and we'll be certain you get notices of those meetings, but they're open to the public, and all of their work is on the web. The primary care question is one we've been talking a lot about. You're right. There are several initiatives. In fact, there are about four or five. There's so many initiatives happening that I can't keep them all straight. It's actually very confusing. And it's creating a bit of a problem out in our communities because there's a federal initiative to pay practices that are certified as primary care medical homes at different tiers of their certification. There's another project that one's just in Medicaid. There's another project in that brings together commercial payers and Medicaid to provide some incentive payments for primary care. We have our own state program, and they all have different rules. And there's a most recent program where the all providers in Medicaid across the country, we need to assure the states that they're receiving at a minimum Medicare payment rate. So there's about four or five different ones. We can get you a list of them. It's actually something we're looking to begin to put together to help better educate providers out there, because I'll be honest, it's very confusing. But it's great. On the one hand, it's great to have the support. On the other hand, not everybody is clear what they're eligible for and how those payments are supposed to happen.
Thanks. And if I could just make a follow-up comment. I think that's it's been very confusing to try to keep an eye on those. And if there's a way that we can help disseminate that information to our constituents who are medical providers, I think all of us would like to help in that regard.
Representative Conger.
Since Senator Shields did it, I'll give you two questions, too.
Okay. Great.
One relates back to the issue of that you were talking about a couple of minutes ago about providers and disputes about being admitted, I guess, to the CCO. The question there is, I think you were describing an administrative process, so a claim is made or a complaint is made with OHA. What do you think about expanding the dispute resolution process that was set out in the statute and making it more permanent instead of just in connection with formation? That's question one. Question two is, at the beginning of your testimony, you talked about a number of examples of progress being made by CCOs related to transformation initiatives or projects. Number one, are any actually up and running? I think what I heard was plans, which is great, and by the way, I understand and I want to reiterate, we're early in the process. I know these CCOs are struggling to form, let alone start to push these initiatives forward, but it's also December and next year is going to be here before you know it. So is anyone actually implementing at this point? And if they are, where are they finding the money? So that was actually like four questions, I think.
It's okay. Chair Mona Sanderson, Rep. Conger, members of the committee. We've actually been giving some thought to making permanent the alternative dispute resolution process. And really think that we can play a role and helping mediate some of those disputes. I think the issue comes down to at what level. We've been working in a couple of communities on some large disputes with large organizations. When you get down to each individual provider complaint and dispute, I think we'll have to think through that in terms of the amount of time and resource. But I do think it's really effective in putting together that, making permanent the alternative dispute resolution process, I think is a great idea. We are seeing in many communities things not just planned but happening. Lane County, they're already implementing a lot of that tobacco prevention work. In Roseburg, they've put together some work to enhance availability and access to mental health care, and they've seen a dramatic increase in the number of referrals and access to mental health services in that community. So I think that there are a number of examples of these things happening. Where are they getting the money? The dollars are coming out of the global budgets. There has not been any additional money from the state, and I think that's one of the challenges that I always talk about in doing this. That, and we've discussed this, we're asking for a tremendous amount of change, and we haven't made a huge capital investment in that change, and I think we've got to be honest about that. We recognize it. I know that the CCOs recognize it. And I think people are being creative, and hopefully the investments are starting, and they're being smart in making the kinds of investments that will have the biggest and most rapid return on those. I think that's why many of the communities, such as yours, are focusing on, you know, complex chronic conditions where there's a real sense that you can make a quick impact and hopefully see a return on that investment. So it is happening, and it just gives me an opportunity to talk about one thing that I didn't mention, which is some of the support for that, however, that we hope to provide as the state. We are in the process of setting up the Transformation Center so that this is a way that we can share innovations and best practices across the state. We're hiring the innovator agents, which were called for by the legislation, to work with CCOs and communities as well to share those innovations. We are hoping that we will be successful in some federal support for a much larger scale transformation center to be able to set up learning collaboratives and technical assistance to CCOs to do some of this. We hope to hear in early January about that. So I think that there will hopefully be, over the course of the year, a number of investments, not so much in capital, but certainly in technical assistance and in some expertise to help communities around the state.
May I follow up just briefly on that point? So I appreciate you not publicly announcing the salary range on the innovator agents, because I'm afraid the room would clear out, people in the audience would rush to apply, and maybe some of us up on the dais too. I think that there's some promise in what you're saying, but part of the beauty of the CCO system is that it allows innovation to occur at a local level and be driven by people who are actually in contact with patients, you know, more in tune to their community and the needs and the demographics and the issues. And so I hope that what doesn't happen is that it starts to be more top-down driven from OHA. I think that would be a failure.
Rep. Conger, I totally agree, and the intent is not to have it be top-down, but actually just the opposite. It's to be bottom-up. These innovator agents at one are hopefully going at a CCO's request can be one located in the community. A part of that organization, a piece of what they will also be doing is helping to be bureaucracy busters and to really make it easier for communities to work where this is about, quite frankly, our moving our workforce out into the community to be co-located with CCOs should they desire, and to not have this be where we dictate from Salem how to do things, but the innovator agent is supposed to help also us better understand how we need to make change and make that change. So, and I know different communities have different degrees of enthusiasm about the innovator agents, which really points to the fact that we've got 15 very different communities, CCOs, and experiments going on, and we've got to be flexible to do that. Some communities have been very upset that they don't have one yet. Others have said we're not so interested, and we're working through that.
We have about 10 more minutes and three more members with questions. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much. I have a couple. First, the question of the 17, and you and I have had this conversation. I still don't understand how you can use 17 different items to create. I mean, is it if you get 9 out of the 17, you win, or you get a certain amount for each one, or you have to get all 17 in order to be incentive? How would something like that actually work with that many measures?
Chair Monis Anderson, Rep. Greenlick, members of the committee, there are 17 metrics. There will be dollars apportioned across those 17, and there will be different benchmarks.
So I could fail on 15 to 17 and still get incentive money because I succeeded on 2?
If you met some of the incentive targets on 2, you would get 2/17 or close to their amount of the dollars, but you wouldn't get everything.
And there's no penalty if you don't get them. There's only a reward if you do hit the... I mean, if I fail on all 17 measures, am I going to be back next year?
Two different issues. I mean, the penalty is that these are dollars coming out of the global budget. So it's taking 2% of the global budget and moving it towards payment for performance. So not getting those dollars is, I would say, a penalty. It's certainly not getting a gain. The issue is that there's also a number of monitoring. Those are for financial incentives. We also are monitoring quality and service and access. And at some point, if organizations are not meeting goals and are failing behind, then we would do a couple of things. We would, one, look to provide some technical assistance and support to help organizations improve. And then if they didn't and they weren't providing quality services, we would be in a position where we would have to consider no longer contracting with an organization. So there's both... there are monetary incentives for quality and for improvement, but there's also monitoring that we do around quality of service. And we need to be prepared to both help organizations as well as, if they're not meeting those goals, think about some alternatives.
And what I hope is a brief question. There's, I think, $120 million in tobacco settlement money that have gone into the, I guess, into the general mix of healthcare. Is there any way to get some specific portion of that, a few million, to the CCO specifically earmarked for tobacco reduction?
Chairman, members of the committee, we, I believe, have some tobacco cessation metrics that I believe are part of the financial incentive metrics, but I will let you know. I'm sort of looking through my list right now.
I'm wondering whether that innovation fund could be used that way or some portion.
It could be. We have, in the governor's budget, there is $30 million in innovation money, and likewise, that could be earmarked towards tobacco prevention.
Thank you,
Ben. One thing I would like to add is that people need to remember that we have a majority partner and a large investor in our Medicaid program, and that's the federal government. They've invested $1.9 billion in this transformation. And quite frankly, many of the metrics and the work and the incentives has been very much, it's been a very important thing for the feds, and has been some of that at their direction. They feel that they're making this investment in us, and this is some of the ways that they've wanted to see, to assure that their investment is going to good use. So it's been a partnership, and we don't have the final word in a lot of those quality metrics.
Representative Cunningham.
Thank you. I think mine's more just a statement of appreciation. Each time I've contacted you or your office regarding alternative providers, dental, a host of other questions, I get a very prompt and specific response, and I think that's commendable. I just thought I'd put it out there. Thank you.
Well, thanks. We try to be. I think the real work's happening. I mean, what's amazing, you got to go around the state and see what's happening in communities.
Yep.
It's been amazing.
Representative Parrish.
Well, I was going to mention alternative providers as well. I think there's definitely an interest from this committee, it sounds like, in that. One of the things I am hearing is that there are folks in the alternative care community who just don't feel like they're being engaged with a seat at the table. And so can you kind of speak to what the timeline is to do that? I've heard it from some chiropractors in my community. Rep. Kenny Geyer and I have been working on the midwife issue, and that was very adamantly clear in many of our meetings, is that they would like to come on as soon as they can, but also be more kind of engaged in the thought process behind how they become engaged.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Rep. Parrish, members of the committee, we've been encouraging that. We've been posting lists of contacts. We've been encouraging providers to work through the community advisory councils, as well as directly through the leadership of the CCOs. I know that there are a number of people who haven't felt heard, and we're working and encouraging that to happen. I think we need to give it a bit more time, and hopefully it will. If it doesn't, we'll need to think about how to take some additional steps to be certain that it does. Around the midwife issue, one thing I just want to be certain that you're aware of and others is that access to midwives has been largely provided through our fee-for-service program. And I know there was a lot of concern by both OHP members as well as midwives about access to that as we were moving people from fee-for-service into CCOs. You know, I've made the decision to keep things as they've been for the last decade, which is that any woman that would like to see a midwife can be in the fee-for-service program and do that. And we're going to keep that for, you know, at least the next several months while we can really work through, I think, some of the ways to more formally get some of that engagement and systems of care in place. And where that will end up, I don't know. But in the meantime, trying to assure that women still have access to midwives as they've had for, you know, in the past in the Oregon Health Plan, and we'll work through it. I think these are going to be, they're going to be tough issues to work through, but I'm always somewhat optimistic that we can make some progress.
Thank you. Representative Cruz. Senator Cruz.
Got a promotion.
You promoted him.
You'd be careful. Mitch was really unhappy with that. So, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, first an observation on the inclusion of dental. I would suggest, for example, that Umpqua Health Alliance said Vantage Dental's been on the board since day one. I would suggest legislative intent was not to prohibit that sort of inclusion, but to set a timeline when it had to happen. So if you're looking for legislative intent, I would suggest that was where we were at. Another comment, conversation I had with Bobby Green probably 8 months ago, about transparency. And since that conversation, I have come to hate the term. Okay. And because I think what we need is more along the line of simplicity. Okay. And so just a comment, at some point in time for this whole thing to work, people have got to be able to understand what's going on. And knowing full well that as long as the federal government is involved, that becomes incredibly difficult. But you know, I'm looking at some of the same concerns maybe Mitch had about what we are measuring. And knowing full well that you don't have total control over that, I think we're creating another jigsaw puzzle that may be hard to understand. Okay, now to my question. Let me preface the question by saying that we are very front end on this, and one would assume the legislation we have done the last couple cycles was incredibly significant, incredibly aggressive. And at some point in time, we not kind of need to let the dust settle. So are you anticipating any significant legislation in 13 around CCOs?
Not from our vantage point.
Okay.
But I can't speak for the legislature.
Well, Madam Chair, I
there might be some.
You know, I'm not talking about tweaking around the edges of anything, but from my perspective, it's time to kind of, we've created something, let's let it develop. And deal with it once we, like I said, you need to let the dust settle sometimes. You keep tweaking with stuff, you never know what you have as a baseline. So,
Senator Cruz, I totally agree. And I'm just going through my mind our ledge concepts, and I don't think there's really anything that changes things. I'm of the same mind you are. We need to give this time to work. We're 133 days into this. And your comment about transparency, I guess the word I often, it's we have to have usable information. Just having
that's
it be...
That's a good one. I like that.
Okay. You know, we can get information out there. If people can't read it, access it, understand it, it doesn't mean a whole lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And the final person, not representative, Senator Shields.
We've been together a long time already.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And going back to your transparency question, I think we also need to be clear how these decisions are being made and how resources are being allocated. But my question is, a constituent just recently expressed some frustration that HealthShare and some others haven't been providing the leadership on reducing health disparities like they should. Can you speak to that and tell me, and I think their point of view was that it's going to require the health authority to really step in and demand that. Can you speak to that for me?
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, members of the committee. One focus on the transformation plans is plans to work on and reduce disparities in healthcare. So we will be looking at those transformation plans, and we will be judging them for their effectiveness in doing that. The other way that we'll be monitoring this is we're working on having all of the incentive metrics broken out also by race and ethnicity. So we can, although that's not going to be part of what the financial performance is on, it is going to be part of how we're looking at the success of CCOs. So I think we've got the plans in place to assure that there are substantive efforts to address disparities across the state.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg, and thank you, too, to all your staff. We look forward to hearing more in the future.
Thanks.
All right. Let's move on to Cover Oregon, our Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, Rocky King. Are you going to come by yourself, Rocky, or should we have Lou Savage and Janine Smith come? And before you start, I hope that in your presentation that you will address the ability to compare plans, apples to apples, those that are in the individual exchange, as well as what they'll see as they shop.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the executive director for Cover Oregon, which is Oregon's health insurance exchange. And I'm going to, I know Lou Savage has a part of this half hour, so I'm going to try to walk through this as quickly as I can. And Madam Chair, I'll try to hit that subject if I may. So let me start off really quickly as kind of a reminder of what our mission is to improve the health of Oregonians by providing access and coverage options, fostering quality and value in our healthcare system. So ultimately, we want to get people healthy in Oregon. Just building and implementing an exchange by itself is not the important thing, but you know, we really want to, I think, make a difference long term on the health of all Oregonians. The timeline to 2013 and beyond, just to kind of give you a picture of that. I'm hoping that that was not my second slide, but it could be the slide that's on here. A couple of things I want to point out by this. A lot of people think we have 10 months before, you know, this has to be completed. I want to look at, have you look at the April date. Our IT portion of this project, basically, from really designing and building it, is done in April of this year, basically, or next year, 5 months from now, or 4.5 months from now. So we are really, really at a fast pace. We call it the hockey stick, where you started really slow and now we're really going quite fast. But we will be done with the exchange build at the end of April and really start a 4 or 5 month intensive user interface testing, where we bring people to really test the system and make sure that you know, it gives the right quotes, and make sure that if 10,000 people get on it at the same time, it works, to make sure as people walk through the interface that it makes sense to them, that they have the information or the information is asked for in a way that they'll understand it. So I think it's really important to understand that the project really is in the implementation phase, not just in the design and build phase as we talk. We also want to look at that this is not a one-year or two-year project. I try to convince my staff of this all the time, that it's not January 1, 2014. That's not the end. The end really is in the 2017 and 18 from a design and build phase, because as soon as we implement in 14, we're talking about really looking at expanding to groups of 100, and then in 2017 expanding beyond. So just a good picture that things are accelerating a lot faster. And I want to point out that the past, you know, when people bought insurance, they asked a friend, they called an agent who may represent only three carriers. They called a carrier, got a whole bunch of plan information, maybe from two or three carriers. How did they compare that? All of that with the exchange is really changing. We are talking about how health care is really purchased in this state, and we're going to see that starting in 2014, that really changes. We've included, and I think you have a big chart that you can kind of look at, kind of from start to covered, and it really develops the pathway that people are going to utilize when they come to the exchange. First of all, you're going to determine whether you're a group or individual, and that will send you in two different directions. But for many families, you'll go in both directions, because you'll have somebody in group coverage. Perhaps you'll have a child that's in the CHIP program, or a spouse that's in Medicaid, and you'll have an adult that is in group. So this is not just two paths. They're very integrated. But we wanted to provide that for you to show you kind of how people are going to walk through this system and really end up at the end covered. It gets kind of the apples-to-apples question that Senator Moniz and Anderson asked. So there will be standardized plans that all the carriers must offer. Senate Bill 91 made that kind of required in both the bronze, silver, and gold plans. Bronze and silver. We've added gold as also needing to be standardized. Now, when we say that, there's always going to be differences. Differences in formularies, for example. Differences in provider networks. Differences in case management programs. So while you may have the same benefits and the same cost sharing, you know, there's going to be differences. So I like to say it's kind of comparing Macintosh to Golden Delicious. So it'll be apples to apples, but there always will be subtle differences. And we actually want some of those, because we want some innovations about how healthcare is delivered. I want to kind of provide you with an IT update. A lot of people early on said that the exchange is nothing but an IT project, and I want to say it is far from that. We have a lot of things going on other than just the IT development. But I want to give you an idea of what we've done. Since August, we have met with the carrier representatives, the IT representatives, OHA, and the exchange IT folks, to really develop the interfaces. Every week since the month of August, we've had one meeting with two to three carriers where we do a rehearsal of what the agenda is that week. And then 2 days later, we bring all the carriers together to really talk about and help design the interface with, you know, 10, 13 different carriers, whoever wants to participate. I want to share, you see one of the discussions around the table. We usually have between 20 and 30 representatives from the carrier community around the table, and 80 on the phone. So most of these meetings have anywhere from, you know, 100 to 125 participants every week developing the user interface between the carrier community and us. We think we've progressed quite well. These meetings end in December. As I said, the construction of the exchange itself from an IT perspective really ends in April. So we've got a lot of work to do in the next 30 to 45 days, making sure our carrier interface is up to date. This is kind of the user experience page. That's our front page. You've seen the corporate website. What you haven't seen yet really is where, when we go live, people are going to actually go in and enter the system. And this is one of the early prototypes. We are into user testing. What that means is we've got people that we put in rooms, and we watch them as they kind of go through the system, a clickable system. Every page doesn't look good yet. It's what they call in the wireframe stage. But we actually are having small businesses and individuals start to utilize our system. And this testing phase will go on all the way up till we go live in October. There's a lot of interest in pushing that April build date out farther. You know, oh, we can do more things if we just build through May. And the problem that any time you start adding things and wanting us to do things more than what we may have designed, what we call the scope of the system, and you extend that date beyond April, then that just takes away from the user interface testing, and it can lead to, I think, a product that won't be as good to use and easy to use as what we would like. So we really are trying to protect the time from May, June, July, August, where users use this system to make sure it works right. And let me give you another thing we're doing. We're working with Intel now, and they are going to develop for us and with us a number of scenarios that for different families. And they have the ability from servers throughout the state to come into the system all at once. So let's test this thing. If 30,000 people get in on at the same time and have all these different scenarios, and they start banging your system to find out where it breaks, where the vulnerabilities from an IT perspective are. We're working with them, and we'll start that after the system's built sometime in May, June. Community involvement. We're in Bend 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I think, and kind of starting to do some of the community meetings, not to, in the design, but to really start talking about that, again, that user experience, what's important to them. And this is one of the tables we always break out into small groups. We had, with only about a week and a half notice, we had like 80 or 90 people from Bend came to a meeting, and it was great. We had board members there who talked about why they're involved. We had some of our staff to talk a little bit more technical about the exchange, and we broke into groups to talk about what's important to them, what they want to see in terms of some of the interactions they have. We will be doing that more and more as we progress towards implementation, just getting groups involved. And at that meeting, there were agents, there were people on Medicaid, people on the high-risk pool, small business folks, just individuals, some uninsured, some insured. It was just a great time for everybody. So, sleepless in Salem. What keeps me up? Health carrier participation. This is requires a lot of investment on the part of carriers without any guarantee of any enrollments from their part. This is a market turmoil in 2014 with all the ACA requirements kicking in. And so I continue up until we finally say, you know, we've got a handshake deal here and let's sign the agreement next week. I don't want three carriers. Three carriers will not get me coverage in Burns. It will not get me coverage in Coos Bay. So I continue to worry about that. Even though we have a lot participating in the design and especially the IT piece, the final commitment is not made by any carrier at this point. Schedule and trade-offs. Okay, so you want to be able to search through the system for your doctor. I can do that for primary care. I want to do it for my specialty doctors also, to be able to put in a doctor's name and say, here's all the heart surgeons that are, you know, heart surgeon, and here's all the carriers that have that. I can do primary care, but if I have to do all the specialties, I probably would have to delay implementing 2 or 3 months. So we're starting to get to the trade-off stage. It's called scope, time, and money, basically, is what everybody says. I got limited time, October 1. I've got dollars that the feds have already really given us and to design the system, both on the IT and the program side. So the only thing I can play with right now is scope, or bring greater capacity and greater efficiency to managing that scope. So we're in the stage now that when we come up with something and say, oh, we need to do this in the exchange, I've got to go to the scope management folks, really the prioritization of our work, and say, and what is it now that we're not going to do? So it really is hard because we find that we miss things. You know, you just do it. A user, during the user experience, says, well, I want to loop through this, or I want to search on the basis of this, and it might make a lot of sense to us, but now we're to the point where we're running out of time. Yeah, give me another piece of this. I'm already putting a group together for 2016 and 17. You know, the cars of next year have already been designed. So I can't wait till 16 and 17. So I'm already thinking about how I'm going to build in some of this into the next phase, what we call 2.0. Dental options. We're trying to, there's a lot of talk nationally about standalone dental. We have some real challenges because of the way we've built our exchange on the group side with defined contribution, and Lou will talk in a few minutes about the essential health benefits and whether and how we provide pediatric dental versus adult dental, whether we pull it together, whether we separate it. So that's something that we're still working with the standalone carriers and the health, those that are just in this from a health standpoint. We're still working out some of that. Quality and value, that will be something that's on our we're just continuing to look at that, talk about affordability. How can you have an exchange that's going to just perpetuate another 10%, 20% increase next year? We've got to be a part of the transformation system that Bruce talked about. How do we bring greater sense to the pricing of products, and how do you access quality and value? Customer service and call center, I say this every time. October 1, how do you take 300,000 calls or 200,000 calls or 100,000 calls? We know that this is going to be a big challenge. We're developing our call center philosophy and structure now. We're into the build stage. We'll be identifying temporary services that can help us on the initial rollout because we know that we're going to need more than what we can have in one place. So that continues. And then finally, the federal regulations. They're not all out. We are continuing to build without really knowing all the time what it is we're building for. It's just continually drives us crazy, and it drives everybody crazy. I do want to end, though, with most of you probably heard the federal government did announce yesterday Oregon was given conditional approval on their exchange. And the word conditional is we haven't implemented yet, so, and there's still some things that we have to do, but there are pages of requirements and timelines that had to be met in order to receive their certification. We met those. The staff are extremely proud. The IT vendors, OHA, Deloitte, Oracle, I think share in that. And we were one of six states. 22 have announced they want to build exchanges. The others are still fiddling with what they want to do. And out of those 22, so far only six of us, Connecticut, if I start to name them, I'll forget them. But California is not one of those yet. They are still kind of behind a little bit. So we're pretty proud that we're there. Does that mean that we'll make it on time? I don't know. This is a big challenge. We'll do the best we can. I guarantee you there's going to be bumps in the road, but we'll try to manage them the best we can. We're excited. For 25 years, I've said no to people when they called up and said, I can't get coverage and I'm sick and can't afford your OMBIC. What do I do? And I have to say, there's nothing. Every program is basically closed, whether it's FEOP, whether it's the standard population, or if they do have money, you only have two plans here at the high-risk pool. You know, we've been saying that for 25 years, and what I'm excited about is in 10 months, I can start saying yes to thousands of Oregonians. I don't know if the projection page got in there, but we're projecting to have anywhere from 200,000 to 400,000 people in the first 2 years, two, 3 years. So we're thinking we're going to be able to fill this up with some good marketing and some good partnerships with local communities and the partners we have. So I don't want to take too much more time.
Let's call up Lou, and is Janine going to come up too? Yeah.
Can we ask questions at the end of
yes,
all of it?
Yeah. Okay. Let's let them have their time, and then let's ask questions. Yeah.
Co-Chair Mona Sanderson and Co-Chairs Greenlich and Cruz. I'm Janine Smith, the Office of Health Policy and Research. And And of course, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Lou Savage and I think we're here in September, briefly at the very end of your last hearing, or at least half of you's last hearing, just to give you an update on the essential health benefit. To remind you, there are two sort of benchmark plans to be decided, one on the commercial side and one on the Medicaid side. What happened starting in April, the governor appointed a work group, as you might remember, that worked through until the summer, and that then was under the auspices of both the Health Policy Board and the Exchange Board to select what would be our commercial, applying to both the small group and individual market in Oregon. That decision was put forward to the governor and then submitted on to Secretary Sebelius, and that was the Pacific Source commercial plan with some specifications around pediatric vision and dental that were requirements. If you remember, we had to include a plan that had all 10 essential health benefits as outlined in the federal statutes of the Affordable Care Act.
That's for the Medicaid population.
This is for the commercial population. There's a separate process that started this summer in the Medicaid Advisory Committee to look at the requirements around a Medicaid benchmark plan should we choose to expand and move forward, and also because OHP standard does not meet the Medicaid requirements going forward. They have completed their work, and they are presenting that to the policy board this afternoon for their consideration. So Lou and his team have taken over on the commercial side, basically, once that selection was made, to then work through some of their processes, because they're going to have to regulate this plan both inside and outside of the insurance exchange.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Lou Savage, the Oregon Insurance Division. As Janine said, when the plan was submitted to the governor, he then sent it on to HHS. The regulations, the federal regulations, are actually not final yet, which is a little strange because we had to move ahead on our planning. As Rocky indicated, we have some really strict timelines. So we submitted our proposal to the feds before even the proposed rules came out. Those rules will become final towards the end of January. There's a comment period that's going on now. The comment period will close the end of December, and so we expect they'll take about a month to come out with the final rules. We don't expect any big surprises, which is the reason that we are moving forward and that we have to move forward with respect to deadlines that we need, both for form filings that the carriers need to do with the insurance division, and then ultimately for the exchange to get those plan forms and plans so that they can start their work and switch the lights on in October. I know that Senator Mona Sanderson mentioned the apples-to-apples issue. We are in the process of rulemaking for Senate Bill 91, and I think a number of you were here when that bill was discussed, debated, and passed. As Rocky said, the goal was to have some comparisons that consumers can do on the bronze and silver plans. We are literally right in the middle of the rulemaking process. There was an advisory committee that met, as a result of that, made recommendations to the division. The division has put out proposed rules. We are getting a lot of comments, and including some folks on your joint committees, and we are receiving those comments. We ultimately will make a decision on that. We've actually extended that timeline recently because one of the pieces that a lot of folks are looking at is what's called the AV calculator that the feds have put out, which computes the actuarial values for plans, and that's important in terms of carriers and others who are interested in this to determine what the values of those plans are. So as a result of some glitches with this actuarial calculator, this AV calculator, we have extended the comment period. I'm a little reluctant to talk about the rules themselves, but I can tell you what some of the discussions were in the advisory committee, and certainly happy to answer questions about that. But we are, you know, we are in an administrative rulemaking process, so to the extent that people have comments, they actually have to be on the record, the administrative hearing record, and we have a website that people can submit comments. Folks, as I say, folks have done that already. But again, I just want to make sure that people understand that any comments that are made in this hearing are actually not part of the administrative hearing process. And I know that may sound a little strange, but that really is the way the process works.
Representative Doherty.
A comment and a question for Mr. King. First of all, I use the presentation that you have on your website to the Tiger Chamber and their government group, and it was very user-friendly for me, and I'm not real techno-savvy, so I want to compliment you on that. But the second question, I noticed in your timeline, you had school districts in 2015. Is there a limit on the size of the school district, or is it still under 100 employees?
Madam Chair, Representative Doherty, no, there is no limit. Legislature passed a law last session that said that the exchange would allow school districts to opt out of PEB, or community colleges, to come into the exchange beginning October of 2015. There's no limit on size. Opt out of OWEB, I apologize. And there's no limit on size. We will start work on that shortly. And working with the school districts and administrators and different unions that are involved in that process and the design of what that's going to look like. But okay. no limit on the size.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rocky, one of my constituents told me that there's a process beyond going for the three plans that have been proposed with different terminology, like there could be more than three plans if a plan was, quote, innovative or substantially different. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and help us understand that issue?
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, one of the most difficult questions we've had to answer is how many plans can people, carriers offer in the exchange? We ended up with three per metal category, plus one catastrophic, plus one Healthy Kids Connect plan. Okay, so they can offer that. Some of the carriers said, we want to try some innovative things. And the example, let's just use one that's out there now, Providence Health Systems. If we said three plans, gold, silver, you know, for each one of those metal levels, Providence, though, has also Providence Choice, a very limited network that involves more of the integrated system. So we wanted to allow the carriers, Kaiser, whether it's Providence, whether it's Health Net, whoever that may be, if there are innovations other than price and benefits, has to be something other than price and benefits that they can put on the table, we would allow them to put two more. Providence is the best example of that with Providence Choice and the Providence statewide plans. What Regents is doing, for example, with some of the limited network and choices people have between five networks in the Portland area. We don't know what those innovations are. Working with the co-ops, I think they're going to bring some innovative plans in some of the, not statewide, but in some of the areas. So that's why we kind of put that out there.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Rocky. I appreciate that. Can you help me understand, though? I mean, the whole point is to not confuse the consumer on these, and if there aren't significant definitions of innovative or substantially different, how are they going to be able to make those choices?
We don't have a definition in the other than it has to be something other than benefits and cost, and we'll sit down on a case-by-case basis to look at that. Will consumers be confused. If they use the sort routines, when that is price, you know, that's going to be region, that's going to be the benefit level, it can be the grading, because every plan that's offered by a carrier will have a grade. We're going to kind of model it after the Medicare stars that they use, 1 through 5 stars. So that search capacity is going to really bring it down to what we think is a manageable level. Now, if there's too many, we're going to have to make adjustments, because we found in, for example, in Massachusetts, they had too many plans and they pulled back in year two. Others, like Utah, couldn't get enough plans to participate and tried to figure out how to get more plans in there when they did their first mini exchange. So we don't have specific criteria. It's going to be a case by case. The carriers are going to have to show us why that is innovative, other than, again, price and benefits.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm curious about cost and kind of forecasting what these plans are going to cost in terms of premiums. So my question is about mandates. And I understand there are 10 essential benefits that have to be provided through the plans. I don't remember how many, but it seems to me that Oregon has a lot more than 10 mandatory benefits. Have you looked at what the cost differential is between the federal requirements and the state requirements? Or am I completely off base here, and is the exchange not subject to the state requirements? This is really for all three of you. I'm just throwing it out there to see if it sticks.
Chair Rose Anderson, Representative Conger, yeah, probably all three of us ought to weigh in on this. Actually, Oregon's, the basic Oregon plan that most carriers offer, although there's certainly some plans that don't have all of the essential health benefits, a lot of them do. This is actually not as big a stretch for Oregon as other states. I mean, there will be an increase. We are looking at increase in premiums, in the short term, and the insurance division and the governor's office and the exchange, we're working together to see how we can mitigate those increases. But there are a number of different factors that will attribute to that, including the fact that the high-risk pool, OMIP, is, if that goes away and all of those folks come into the market, that has the potential to increase premiums. There's a minimum actuarial value that's required under the ACA, and meaning how much of the medical costs in your plan are covered by the carrier versus by the consumer. That minimum is increasing, and so therefore the plans will be more expensive as a result of that. So there are a number of different factors, and I'm happy to come back and we can dig into that a little bit deeper. But I would say in general, a lot of the plans in Oregon really do have most of the essential health benefits. I don't know if...
Chair Mona Sanderson, Representative Conger. The 10 essential benefits requirements are not quite correlate exactly to mandates that we have in the state, but since Oregon picked a plan that already was an Oregon-based plan, it already covers all of the mandates. And according to the feds, the subsidies that are allowed in the exchange will cover those plans, that any of the mandates that were in existence prior to the end of 2011. So it's a question really going forward of any additional mandates the state might want to put on health plans in terms of how those are handled, and they would, I think Rocky Wright would not necessarily be covered by the tax subsidies.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Conger, I'm old and I can talk a little bit more frank. The market reforms included in the ACA are going to have tremendous market disruption. You're going to see people sitting at this table, if we take no action, that have 3% increases and 200% increases. You're going to see, if we take no action, a young and healthy exit the market, and the general population see, on average, 30-40% increases. We are now working the insurance division really hard with carriers, with the governor's office, with the exchange, to try to figure out what are the strategies to allow in the individual market a soft landing. But the individual market is the most heavily subsidized market we have in Oregon. Underwriting, OMIP, portability in the group market, and all those subsidies based on federal law end. Guaranteed issue, OMIP comes in, portability comes in. We don't have mental health parity in the individual market. People don't have drug coverage to that level in the individual market. They don't have pediatric dental coverage in the individual market. So the benefit pieces in the individual market expand. OMIP, portability populations come in. That's a tremendous challenge. Now, our challenge is to figure out how we can spread that cost initially so that we create a soft landing. But it's a subsidized market. Let's be frank. Let's be open and talk about this is going to be very difficult to manage. And you in both committees, House side and the Senate side, are going to have a variety of proposals around this particular issue. Now, you may disagree with my analysis of it. Some folks in the government and some of the carriers don't. But we're going to have to figure this out, and it's going to be really a tough challenge for us because we want to make sure these markets are stable. That's apologize for scaring people. I don't want to scare people. We have time to deal with this, and the proposals are going to be before you.
I think it would be helpful for me anyway to know, number one, how much time do we have, and number two, to get a better understanding of what pieces of the cost drivers we control. Versus what pieces we can't exercise any influence over, so that we know how much we are adding to that cost and that problem, should it actually happen. I mean, I have a real concern about exactly what you're saying, which is people exiting the market because it's more affordable to pay the penalty rather than continue to be covered by health insurance. And I'm also concerned because I don't have any idea. This to me is kind of a black box. When you talk actuarial stuff, my eyes glaze over and I wonder, what I'm having for dinner. But I'm worried that everyone will see a price increase. And so for our benefit, can I ask that you help us identify those things that we control that are cost drivers?
Yeah.
And compare it to what, the baseline, I guess, is and what we can't control.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Conger, we had an initial study done, and there were a lot of uncertainties in terms of what the federal government was going to be doing. Now that we have a better idea on a lot of that, we're going to try to run those numbers again, and then we will come back to you and give you an idea as to what's set in stone, what we can impact, and what we, what we're just going to have to work on an ongoing basis.
And Madam Chair, Representative Conger, I just want to remind you, but this is a market issue, not just an exchange issue. It really is one, and I just think we have to have some. I can't sit back here and nod and say everything's beautiful and things are going forward. I hope I'm wrong on some of this, but I think we've got to prepare for not being wrong, because if we just don't want to foul up what has been a great market in Oregon, pretty much.
I guess one other point on that. There are subsidies available. The other numbers that we're trying to crunch are, how many folks out there who don't have coverage now, or maybe who do have coverage now, are going to be eligible for those subsidies? And then what's that remaining population look like, and how hard are they going to get hit because they're not going to have the subsidies?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
So I had a question, thank you, Madam Chair, along the lines of who's not covered as well and what strategies are. My recollection is that there are something like 600,000 people in Oregon that do not have insurance, and your estimate is maybe 200,000 to 400,000 that you're hoping to cover. Some of these are people that are going to elect to exit the market or not enter it in the first place. We had a lot of talk last year about navigators and trying to make sure that you have a robust system of trying to help people who might not be hearing about this initially. I just wondered if you could talk about some of your strategies for a population that doesn't normally get LinkedIn to this, and any other strategies you have for how we can attract people to the market.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Goddard, the navigators and the agent program and our outreach program is just absolutely critical. And give you an idea, and I can't remember our number. I remember California's number is their budget's like $700 million for 2013 and 14. They kind of come out with it. And $240 million of that is just marketing and outreach. Ours, I can't remember the percentage, but it's a really large percentage that we've developed. We're now in the process of working with the Oregon Health Authority to take advantage and leverage their relationships with community partners. You know, they have contracts with over 300 community partners that help them in really making Healthy Kids a successful program. They made a lot of mistakes. They learned from those mistakes. We hope to build on their knowledge base. So that's a very important part. Getting into the local communities and having those contracts will be really key. The first 70% of the people we want to enroll are easy. It's the 80% of your money is going to go really trying to target that other 30%. And we've got strategies. We'd be happy to meet with you, lay out our kind of our outreach program, what we've designed. It's, you know, it takes about a half hour, 45 minutes to go through, but I guarantee you that's one of the things key. We can't build this exchange and not have people enroll, so the outreach and marketing obviously is a key thing for us.
Representative Greenleck.
Rocky, I just want to point out the added complexities that go into what you're going to be showing people when you take their subsidies into consideration, and particularly the subsidy. People will have a subsidy on the premium, and they might also have a subsidy on the out-of-pocket expenses. The subsidy on the out-of-pocket expenses will, as you pointed out to our advisory group, come in terms of a reduction in the deductible and a reduction in the coinsurance. So when somebody pops up a plan, it'll have to be personalized for that individual. It'll have to say, well, the regular premium is $500 a month. For you, the premium would be $350 a month, and the regular deductible is $2,000, and the regular coinsurance is 20%. But for you, the deductible will be $1,400, and your coinsurance will be 16% instead of 20%. So this turns out to be a lot more complex than just having apples to apples in the plan. I mean, it will come up. I'm assuming this will come up with an individual quote that will say, for this plan, here's your deductible, here's your coinsurance. For this plan, here's your deductible, here's your coinsurance. And it won't be the standard one. It will be individually tailored. A fair description. I think I've begun to understand this now.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Greenland, you are correct. This is not just here is a silver plan. If you are at 260% of the poverty, you actually see a different silver plan than somebody that's at 240%. And the person at 180% sees a different silver plan. And they may have the same deductible, but they'll have different cost sharing based on income. The federal government has made this extremely complicated. Now, there's one tendency when they do that is to run away from it and let them do it, but I guarantee you, I would rather have us in Oregon working with the advocates, and users, experience, and our carriers to design how that is shown in the system. And then you get into the tribal program, which is another completely different set of cost sharing and premiums to the different silver, gold, bronze plans. So it is complicated. Representative Greenleck, Senator Mona Sanderson, and Representative Thompson are part of an advisory group that we're trying to kind of make sure they understand, and they're giving us some feedback on some thoughts that they have around how we display some of that.
Okay, and finally, Senator Cruz, and then we need to go into recess.
Just very briefly, we are going to be spending an inordinate amount of time in 13 talking about the exchange. I think I think that's front and center on what we're doing. All I wanted to say, Madam Chair, was, Rocky, it is really good to see you, and I hope you're taking appropriate care of yourself.
I hear that from everybody.
Well, I've gone through a couple things myself, and your health is more important than this other stuff, so take care of yourself. That was it.
Thank you. I agree. And I am one day older than you are. All right. The Senate Healthcare Human Services and Rural Health Policy will recess as we go to Hearing Room D.
Can we change the name of the committee? Make it something short.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Representative Thompson and Representative Greenlick. I'm Laura Ocker, and committee members representing the Oregon Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. Thank you for having us here today. I'm here with Dr. Sabo and colleagues to discuss the non-discrimination language in the CCO rollout. Particularly, I'd like to address the topic of network adequacy. First, I'd like to just make a statement about the benefits of a fully integrated healthcare delivery network. From the questions that you all raised to Dr. Goldberg, it sounds as if your constituents have been sharing with you the value that they see in the various forms of medicine, the disciplines that we represent. And when you have a system of care where you have those providers working closely together for the benefit of the patients with a broad spectrum of options, that's a very valuable way to go. So the network adequacy piece is very important to be defined. It's not clearly defined at this point, and I wanted to share with you this definition that our coalition has agreed upon. In the last page of the booklet that I gave you, this statement is written, and so I'll read it to you. A prepaid managed health care services organization or a coordinated care organization that contracts with the Oregon Health Authority must maintain a network of providers from each licensed or certified health profession, sufficient in numbers and geographically distributed to ensure that enrollees and members have reasonable access to all providers and all services under the contract without significant waiting periods or other restrictions on access. And so the key point here is without significant waiting periods and other restrictions on access. You know, if we're saying that we're offering a medical service to our patients, for example, I'm an acupuncturist, we're offering acupuncture to our patients. Perhaps we're working with someone who's struggling with chemical dependency issues, chronic pain, they've just quit smoking, and then suddenly there's a two-week waiting period where they're unable to access an acupuncturist because the acupuncturist schedule is full, because somebody's on vacation, because the network isn't robust enough, then we're not doing that patient a service. And so I just hope that we'll find language that will ensure the open access, the continuity of care, effective treatment plans that we can present to our patients, and prevention of gaps in care. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Representative Co-Chair Thompson and Greenlick, I'm Daniel E. Beeson, chiropractic physician. I have a diplomate status as in internal diagnosis. And I'm not here to tout that. I'm here to say that, and actually I would like to go back and say, I'm a graduate of Western States Chiropractic College in 1974. And when I graduated from chiropractic college, we were a complete holistic chiropractic physician. We were trained in the neuromusculoskeletal system. We're experts in restoring the integrity, finding errors in joint position, and restoring that motion. We also were trained in diagnostics and radiology, blood work, urinalysis, all the standards at that time. We were trained in GYN, obstetrical training. We had to deliver to graduate. And then we went on even to casting. So a chiropractic physician in 1974, and you go back historically, could go to some small community and almost be the physician for that community, and it happened many times. Dr. Weiser delivered 4,000 babies in Tillamook. So we have quite a history like for that. My purpose here today is to let you know we're available as physicians in this state to help the future of the Oregonians get healthier. A couple examples. I'm proud to say that my first patient in clinical training I saw last Friday. 40 years I've managed her with MS. She was diagnosed by Dr. Swank, and with a low-fat diet and nutrition and supplementation and taking care of the neural axis, she's still walking. She uses a wheelchair to get for long distances. Another patient I saw the other day, 30 years ago, biliary disease, gallbladder disease. With adjustments of the spine to the neural axis, opening up the blood flow to that organ, and then the application of betaine through red type fruits and vegetables, particularly the leaf of beets. She still has her gallbladder. I'm thinking of a 12-year-old who had trouble concentrating in school, was tested with IgG testing with blood. On the 96 panels of food, she was found to tolerate 4. So with elimination, she went home to eat four foods. Within the next 4 days, she told her mother she could concentrate, she could think. There's one example there. Now, my most recent gentleman, just yesterday morning, a patient returned to me with chronic pain, level of 8 or 9 on a 0 to 10 scale, retired fireman, fixed him up before. This looked a little different. Major change, he was on Lipitor. Sent him back to his medical physician because under my license I cannot prescribe that medication. He was taken off the Lipitor. Within 3 weeks, his pain level's down to a 1 or 2. So as chiropractic physicians, we're here to look at deficiencies, toxicities. We're touted and known for the neuromusculoskeletal component that we've traditionally dealt with. We have 1,400 chiropractors available. In my specialty, we're being upgraded every 2 years. We hold those courses in Portland and across the state, so everybody's getting updated. I can't get enough to sit the board, but that takes time and energy, and I think it's, insurance companies aren't recognizing our specialties at this time, so it's probably not cost effective. But in my 40 years of clinical experience, given our hands, good nutrition, the availability to find out what else is being toxic to the body, removing those dysfunctions, we restore a lot of health to Oregonians. And I'd like to make sure that the exchange and the CCOs allow us to participate and help restore the health and wellness to Oregonians. Thank you.
Morning, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Dr. Vern Sable representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I'll be real brief. I wanted to touch upon the non-discrimination provisionary language relative to varying reimbursement rates and just to clarify that last session during the rules committee hearings, it was clarified by the Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, Lori Freeman, that in fact varying reimbursement rates could only be applied to quality and performance of that provider, and that that was clarified by Representative Freeman. And again, we would suggest that there should be additional consideration for language that would speak to this issue and simply state that it shall not vary reimbursement rates based solely on licensure or discipline. That was the legislative intent, and I think that's something that should be considered added to the current statute. I'd like to springboard off of Dr. Beeson's comment. He's a board-certified chiropractic internist and does a wonderful job. Governor Kitzhaber told me in private and in several public forums that with the coming health care reform, with all of the Oregonians coming online with the insurance exchange, that there is going to be a huge primary care deficiency, and that chiropractic physicians practicing to the top of their licensure could help fill that void, those who wish to practice primary care. And so what would be the consequence? And we talk about the triple aim, improving the health of a defined population of Oregonians, reducing per capita costs, and improving patient satisfaction and safety. Well, the experiment's already been done in Illinois, and I've spoken of this before. There's a 7-year prospective study, including over some 70,000 member months, the study was such that the consumer could select a chiropractic or naturopathic physician as their primary care physician or a medical osteopathic physician. They followed them through time. Those managed by chiropractic and naturopathic physicians, the following savings were realized over that 7-year period: an 80% reduction in direct drug costs. Now, that doesn't include the costs of indirect costs of adverse drug events, side effects, which have to be treated. In this country, total some 2.2 million hospitalizations and about 1 million ER visits, which is a tremendous cost. There was also a 56% reduction in surgeries and outpatient procedures such as MRI, a 62% reduction in hospitalization, a 56% reduction in hospital days with 95% consumer satisfaction. So putting us in the game, following the non-discrimination provisionary language that is now part of Oregon law, would help, we believe, help achieve those goals. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions to the panel? Okay, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure this isn't the last we're going to hear of this topic, but we have a whole new session opening up ahead of us, so stay vigilant, my friend.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She's got to do her job.
Okay, next up, we have John Mullen, presentation on the basic health plan option. And again, I would ask you to be as brief as possible because we're behind.
Okay.
Nothing new there, but...
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. Medicaid, as you're aware, it has been around since 1964, and it operates very differently in states. We've seen what we've done here in Oregon as far as changing the long-term care system in the 80s, coming up with the Oregon Health Plan in the 90s, transformation, healthy kids, and so forth. In conferring with some of our people at the federal level and the National Health Law Center, we're doing some really innovative things here in Oregon compared to other states. And I'd like to take a couple of minutes this morning to talk about yet another opportunity, and it's the basic health plan. I've been testifying all along to the Oregon Health Fund Board and also during session about support for transformation and where we're heading, but also concerned about a number of things as we look at affordability and churning and continuity of care going forward. So I want to talk a little bit about how the basic health plan would be a potential tool to help with those issues. I'm going to go over the handout that is attached to my testimony from Emily Katz from CARE Oregon. I want to just say that she did an excellent job with distilling a number of pieces of information, but I want to point out that CARE Oregon itself has no position on the basic health program. So if you go to that slides, the PowerPoint there, I just want to begin with talking a little bit about the ACA provision for the basic health program. Senator Cantwell was the one that put this into the ACA, and it was because state of Washington was already covering adults up to 200% of the federal poverty level. So this is something that was really generated from the state. Oregon has not been so generous with adults and certainly with adults without children. But the way that this would work would that the BHP funding would be based on 95% of the premium tax credits and the cost-sharing subsidies that would otherwise be available through the exchange. The eligibility would be to people 138% of FPL up to 200% of FPL. And importantly, it would also give us the opportunity to serve legal immigrants who otherwise are in a waiting period, the five-year waiting period before they would be eligible for Medicaid. The estimates by the Urban Institute is roughly 110,000 people would be eligible in Oregon, and maybe as many as 72,000 would apply. I'm going to skip over, in interest of time, a couple of the slides. You'll see that there are a number of states that are considering the basic health program, and in fact, a number of the states that already have expanded eligibility for adults. For example, here in the state, we have cervical and breast cancer eligibility, as well as serving pregnant women. And we'll have to think about how we do the conversions of those as we look at moving 138% of poverty level for basically for Medicaid for the cost eligibility for the eligibility. Affordability is probably the most important issue to take a look at about what the distinctions are and the differences. As you've heard the presentations this morning, both from Bruce and from Rocky, as we think about a number of things that people who are very low income beginning to think about accessing the exchange or making a decision perhaps to pay the penalty in lieu of doing that, you can see that the differences in cost between the premium cost for the exchange of being $1,180 and BHP premium cost being $100, that's a significant difference. Also, the out-of-pocket maximums of $548 through the exchange and $112 with a BHP in place. And you see also the monthly breakdown of that. So those are really significant differences. The next page talks about the potential effects of BHP, and I'll just go over a couple very quickly. It's more affordable. It increases overall participation and coverage, again, there's a question mark about how many people in that range, 138 to 200% of federal poverty level, will choose to access on the exchange. There'll be less churn between Medicaid and the exchange, meaning that people moving back and forth from Medicaid to the exchange will be lessened somewhat by looking at people with higher levels of income. The continuity of care is also a potential benefit that we can have plans that sell on the exchange that also have provisions for serving people with Medicaid. There's also the potential for some general fund savings to the state of Oregon. But I'll end with talking about some potential obstacles. The unfortunate thing is that CMS at the federal level, of course, has been busy with a number of things, and they have not issued the final rules on the basic health program. It would probably have been best if we had the rules in hand now and we could take a look at what we would do here in the state of Oregon and how it might affect other systems, like what would happen with the number of people who would be on the exchange as opposed to BHP. But I also just want to mention that this has had a limited amount of discussion in the state of Oregon compared to other states. I have testified at the Oregon Health Policy Board, and the Oregon Health Authority wrote a paper in response to a request to look into it a little bit more. You'll also see the Allies for a Healthier Oregon have a statement about their support for looking into this issue. And I would simply close by saying that if we don't exercise the basic health program, I still believe we need to come back to those basic issues that we have in front of us. So what happens about affordability? What are we going to do to minimize churn? And what are we going to do to ensure that there'll be continuity of coverage? And so with that, given the time, I'll end there and see if there are any questions.
Questions, comments?
John, I'm still hazy about how the BHP is different than other options in either the exchange or in the Medicare. I mean, it's outside the Medicaid expansion because it's over 138.
Right.
But what makes it different than other options in the exchange?
Well, just thinking about it from a consumer aspect, Representative Greenlit, members of the committee, from a consumer point of view, it's really all about the affordability. What we would want to make sure is that we had a Medicaid CHIP-like program so there would be some symmetry with Medicaid so that the benefits would be essentially the same. So from a consumer perspective, and also to provide a more seamless system, it would be better all the way around.
This wouldn't be run by an insurance company. It would be handled like a Medicaid product.
Representative Greenlit, members of the committee, that's right. It would be handled by OHA and not through the exchange. In fact, the subsidies would not be available to people in the BHP, but basically the subsidies that would have gone to them and the cost sharing goes to the state.
Thank you.
Shane County Guyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us a, if this became eligible and you had close to full enrollment, what it would cost the state and what money from Washington, D.C. we would be drawing in? I don't know what the ratio is, but...
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Guyer, Kenny Guyer, that's a great question, and it's one of the reasons why we are looking forward to having further analysis of what makes sense with basic health program. If we do this, and we would have to spend a considerable amount of time costing it out to make sure that the state would have the revenue from what would have been the subsidies and the cost sharing to make sure that it would be whole. That's information I don't have at my fingertips about what the cost would wind up being, but it's really a part of the question that we need to answer. As we look at the number of people that wind up applying for coverage through the exchange, one of the concerns that is there from all around the country is how many people that are very low income, above 138% of FPL, will actually participate. And so even if we get the exchange up and operating, and we worked at it backwards and did the BHP later on, because we had such low uptake for people 138 to 200% of the federal poverty level, all of the costs and conditions would all have to be analyzed based on, and we'd have to reforecast the numbers depending on how many people actually went through the exchange.
one more question?
Please,
thank you.
Yes.
As a follow-up also, you know, structurally, I hate to see a third kind of bureaucracy. Would you imagine that this could be administered through Cover Oregon or through Medicaid?
Co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, we're all heading towards that idea of the exchange really having two brains, as the Cover Oregon staff like to say, that it should be relatively seamless for the person as far as Medicaid and exchange products are concerned, because it'll be gathering information to help determine that eligibility. So I think the basic health program would fit in very much seamlessly with that process.
In the exchange?
Yes.
Okay, seeing no more questions, thank you, John. I'm sure we'll be back to this topic as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, team, next up we're going to do in interim work group panels. At 10:45 promptly, we're going to stop this testimony and move to introduction of committee bills, because at 11 o'clock we will not have a quorum, so we have to get that done. So if you're speaking at 10:45, you will not be speaking at 10:46, and we'll try to get back to you. So I hate to be hard about it, but certain things have to happen today. So first up, we have the DUII work group. That will be Chuck Hayes from the Governor's Advisory Panel, Amy Joyce from ODOT, Troy Costales will be on the phone, I understand.
Join the conference.
And Dina Tyerson, Assistant Attorney General. And while they're coming up, just a quick note, very brief for time. This is a result of a work group we've been operating over the past several months that I instituted, asking the question, can we update Oregon's DUII laws? Can we coordinate better between the various agencies? And also, moving into healthcare transformation, we are recognizing that substance abuse is now a primary healthcare problem. And how do we coordinate law enforcement and medical care and get things done properly? We can no longer just take an intoxicated person, repeatedly arrest them, repeatedly throw them in jail, and act as if it's not a healthcare problem. It is a healthcare problem now. So all of these things, I think I charged the committee with making Oregon a leader in DUII and substance abuse, and to my great satisfaction, I think they actually are doing it. For a committee of 30-some people to come together and actually accomplish something, I don't remember that happening often. So I'm extremely pleased with the progress that's been made. And with no more, I turn it over to you people.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and committee members. I'm Chuck Hayes, the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I didn't know if Troy was going to be speaking first.
I want to make sure. Troy, okay. Are you on the phone? This is Sandy with the House Healthcare Committee.
Good morning. Yes, I am, and I can go ahead and start if you'd like.
It's up to you and the panel, so let me get the volume up a little bit now. And okay, I think you're good to go.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Troy Costales, the administrator of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I want to thank you and Representative Thompson and Representative Greenlick for putting together this work group related to DUII. And you may ask why the healthcare committee should be engaged in this beyond what Representative Thompson introduced. And that is, at any one point in time in Oregon, 55 to 60,000 people are under the state's care related to substance abuse. The largest place where individuals enter into that system is from being removed from the road by a law enforcement officer because of driving under the influence of intoxicants. 25,000 people of that 55,000 committed the system because of a DUI arrest. The conversation around the table that we've had over the past year has been around, how do we coordinate this conversation? How do we help this individual that has shown in a very public and dangerous way an issue with substance abuse? How do we help coordinate the conversation of the evaluation and the treatment and the conversation in court and with probation with the healthcare community to help this person become, you know, safe and sober and a productive member of society? And so that, in part, is what this small set of bills that are on your list for later this morning to consider are all about, is to helping ensure that that DUI system gets better, because if the DUI process gets better, that in turn is going to have a direct impact on helping our healthcare system within the state get better, and these individuals, one by one, become a better member of society and to kick the habit that they may have found themselves under. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would go ahead and close now and turn this over to the rest of the panel to talk about the concepts that you have under consideration this morning.
Thank you, Troy.
And Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, again, I'm Chuck Hayes, the Chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. We very much appreciate the fact that we were invited to participate in this work group discussing impaired driving. And as a result of that, our committee has really come up with five legislative concepts, and so we are just going to briefly touch on those this morning, because we do feel that there are some issues within the impaired driving system here in Oregon that really do need to be worked upon. The first one is legislative concept 180, and 180, what that does is it expands the definition of DUI so that it will include substances that go beyond our statute right now, other than just alcohol-controlled substances and inhalants. And I might tell you that Oregon is one of eight states in the country that does not have a statute that includes any impairing drug or any impairing intoxicants or substances. So we would like to kind of catch up with the rest of the country when it comes to that. And what this does is it will allow us to, again, expand that definition so that if a person is under the influence and is noticeably affected to some perceptible degree and they're driving and they're under the influence of a drug that might fall outside of our statute, maybe something that is a non-controlled substance, or maybe over-the-counter substances that have impairing effects, well, then we would be able to take some action against that individual for driving under the influence and then subsequently get that person into some sort of treatment. And as I said, Oregon's just one of eight states in the country that does not have that now.
Would that include somebody addicted to texting?
I'm sorry.
So would that include somebody addicted to texting?
It could.
That's a good
because
question.
Because they do a lot of different things when they're under the influence, that's for sure. But one of the things we're definitely concerned about, and I'm sure you are as well, is that with all of these new substances that are being manufactured every single day, I just checked with a reputable laboratory in the United States, and now they're estimating that synthetic cannabinoids, there's 383 different versions of those now that are available to the public. And so we cannot keep up with those substances. When somebody's under the influence of those, then they fall outside the scope of DUI. And then that doesn't even get into the area of like the new synthetic stimulants that are out there as well. So those are things that people are driving under the influence of, and we cannot actually take action against those individuals for driving under the influence, and they subsequently then fall outside the treatment scope as well. So that's why we're looking at legislative concept 180. It's still a work in progress, but that's where we stand on that one. And I'm going to let these two ladies then talk about the other legislative concepts.
Good morning, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick. My name is Dina Ryerson, and I work for the Department of Justice. I'm going to talk about two concepts that are part of this committee. The first one is legislative concept 178. And what this has to do with is when someone is suspected of driving under the influence of drugs, they are asked to do a drug recognition evaluation, and they're asked to do this by someone who has extensive training and experience in detecting someone under the influence of drugs. This concept allows for the evidence gathered under this drug evaluation to be admissible as evidence when not all 12 steps of the evaluation are complete. And usually this happens because the person refuses to give a urinalysis as required by statute when an officer believes they're under the influence of drugs. And so when they refuse to give the urine sample, it's the 12th step, and it changes what kind of evidence is admissible in trial. This legislative concept is needed to ensure consistency among the courts across the state, which has been the issue at this point. And the next legislative concept I'll talk about is 189. And currently, there are two different ways to get an ignition interlock requirement. And one has to do when somebody's been convicted of DUI. They're required at some point to have an ignition interlock device in their car. Another way is through a diversion, entry into diversion, and this happens when somebody has driving privileges reinstated while on diversion. They're required to get an ignition interlock. Currently, when someone has an ignition interlock requirement as a condition of a conviction, there are certain exemptions that are available to them, and one of those exemptions have to do when they are driving an employer-owned vehicle, that they are not required, they can ask to not have the ignition interlock placed on that employer-owned vehicle. The other exemption is a medical exemption. If for some reason they're unable to maybe blow into the device, and that's another exemption that they may be able to get to the ignition interlock requirement for conviction. What LC 189 is allows those two exemptions to also apply to someone who is required to get an IID as a condition of diversion. So it's kind of making the law consistent on both sides. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and we participated in the work group on sort of two fronts, ODOT's Transportation Safety Division, and then also the DMV, which is heavily involved with things like suspensions. Two concepts then that I'll cover. The first is LC 257, which goes over a number of items with the ignition interlock requirement. One is that it closes a loophole that currently exists in the law. When a person is suspended after a conviction for DUII, they then have a subsequent requirement to install that IID for either 1 or 2 years. The way the law is written is a person can simply wait out that additional 1 or 2 years, so this concept would close that and require that they actually install and use the device for the full term. Secondly, it describes more thoroughly where a report goes when a person uses the IID and fails. They test positive for alcohol or they tamper with the device. It's unclear right now what happens to that report, to whom does it go, and what are the consequences. So 257 starts getting at what happens with that report and what the consequences are. And so that's really what 257 does. I would say that it is currently a work in progress. LC is continuing to work on this. It's a pretty complex area of the law, so it is that concept's a work in progress. The other concept, 832, under current law, when a person wants to get their license reinstated after a DUI conviction, they are supposed to present to DMV a certificate showing they completed treatment and very specific requirements on that treatment. And DMV also has the authority to grant exceptions for that. That law was passed in the short 2012 session as a stopgap, and that law is set to sunset on January 1st of 2014, with the understanding that we would be back talking about what the right way is to handle that situation. And so the solution in 832 is that function really is transferred to the court. So the court, if it decides that the person hasn't adequately completed treatment, they're going to tell DMV, don't let that person reinstate, and then that goes on the person's record. And then would presumably have that exception authority rather than DMV. I would say that 832 is also a work in progress. Clearly that's an impact to the courts, and so that is continues to be under discussion, but as they're drafted, those are those two concepts.
Good. Any questions? Yes.
I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about this later. I was a little unclear with the LC 189 about the exemptions, whether it's actually tightening or loosening those exemptions.
Co-chairs and Representative Kangeyer, what LC 189 does is it just makes the existing exemptions also apply to people who are required to get ignition interlocks while they're on diversion. So it's keeping the same exemptions but allowing someone who's on diversion to also have those exemptions available. That was neglected to be put in as part of the statute in 2011 when that bill was passed on diversions. So it's not really expanding it, just making the same exemptions consistent for both conditions where you have to have an IID on conviction as well as diversion.
A brief question,
certainly.
Mr. Chair. I think some of the lobby groups view me as a soft on crime person, but as I see as I read in the newspaper, cases where somebody's been killed in a traffic accident, frequently you find that they have been convicted and are driving while suspended. Did the task force talk about what we can do about that? It just seems pretty common for people to just drive. And I assume they have to get a different car than the one they have the interlock device on.
Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson, again, Amy Joyce from ODOT. I would say the work group did not address that topic, and to me that topic is much broader than the DUII conversation. I would say that the issue of driving while suspended and what to do about folks who continue to drive, which is a huge percentage, the studies tell us, is a bit of a conundrum that has existed in this state for many years. Task forces and work groups have looked at it. It's an issue across the country, what to do about it. ODOT actually, the Transportation Safety Division, has an innovative thing that they've been piloting, looking at. We'd be, I think, happy to come back and talk with you about what we're doing with law enforcement to try to crack that nut that's so difficult to do.
I expect most of these LCs are going to end up in judiciary rather than here, but
I think it could be dual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll ask for them.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
Your solution, your problem might be to make driving while suspended a capital crime.
I wouldn't want to go that far. I thought pillories would.
Pillories? I'm for pillories. I'll try anything.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I really want to commend this work group for the work, the volume of work they've been doing. I would have never asked the question had I known what a thorny issue this was. But I think that we have a number of agencies working together now. The governor's task force has been incredible in supporting this effort. And I think we actually are accomplishing a whole lot more than this short segment today indicated. But it's been interesting. I may ask for reinstatement of that work group, too, as we move forward. So.
Troy, do you have any closing comments?
I just want to reiterate what Chair Thompson had said. It was a lot of work done in a short amount of time, and there was a pretty broad audience at the table, and I appreciate his leadership in Representative Greenlick, Krieger, and Barker as well, helping bring this together so that we could come together on a unified front and give you a complete package that solves some of the issues that we're faced with in the state.
I do want to reiterate, this is truly a bipartisan effort, including the governor's office. We had a good mix of people involved here, and hopefully we can move something forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have a report from the Direct Entry Midwives Work Group. Nothing controversial here. And I would like to call Representative Kenny Geyer. Representative Perry seems to not be with us at the moment. And Silke Akerson.
Would you like me to sit up there?
It's
here?
Up to you. You can testify from there. You're on. So
I'm fine from here.
Okay, that's
thank
fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just kick this off and say you're right. It's controversial, but it's a really important issue. And I think all of us have come to it from really wanting to make sure that women in Oregon have a choice for a home birth and that we make it as safe and as accessible as possible and that it really is aligned with the triple aim goals of health transformation, of being patient-centered care, quality care, bringing down the cost of care. I want to thank Representative Parrish, who has been my co-chair on this committee. Representative Val Hoyle was also on the committee. Sandy has done a fabulous job of staffing it. We've had great cooperation from OLA, first the first director, Randy Everett, and then the interim new director, Holly Mercer. We've had many people I see here in the audience who have come consistently representing OMA, OHSU, Certified Nurse Midwives, Direct Entry Midwives, lots of participation by the community. And then our work group has been made up of Silke Akerson, who will introduce herself, a licensed Direct Entry Midwife, Shafia Monroe, who is an unlicensed Direct Entry Midwife. We had two Certified Nurse Midwife categories. One of those was Monica Arce from Virginia Garcia Clinic. Another was split between Kate Pelosi and Judith Rooks, depending on which of them could come.
We had two doctors. One was an OB as well as a naturopath, Dr. Alan Hedges, and another was Dr. Duncan Nielsen, also an OB from Emmanuel, who's also head of Women's Health Services. And we had a naturopath physician and also midwife, Sarah Gucci. So a great committee that met on seven different occasions since last summer, and it is also a work in progress. I'll just highlight a couple of areas, and then I'll give you more opportunity to go into it. The kind of heart of the bill is to make licensing mandatory for direct entry midwives. And we have fairly good consensus, and that's not been an easy process. And Silke may highlight some of what it took to get there, and she's been a huge leader in this discussion in her own community and in the broader community. Another piece has been having to do with governance within OLA. The Board of Direct Entry Midwives is within OLA, and we are recommending changes in terms of giving more authority to the direct entry midwives for the rulemaking and investigations. So there's fairly good consensus along that. And then we are also discussing under what conditions there will be exemptions for around religious and cultural reasons for whether to be exemptions to licensing, and then also the possibility of exemptions for those who operate in a license but might operate out of a scope of practice for particular situations. These are all details that we can go into in greater detail. There's a question about the naming, whether we change the name or not, and then huge questions about financing and liability. So lots of issues on the table. I think we've made great progress. And I'll turn it over to Silke.
Well, thank you for having me, Co-Chairs Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson and members of the committee. My name is Silke Akerson, and I'm a licensed direct entry midwife and the president of the Oregon Midwifery Council. And this work group very much came out of concerns of some members of this committee and met concerns from members of the public. We've had a voluntary licensure program in Oregon since 1993 for direct entry midwives who provide services for out-of-hospital births in people's homes and in birth centers. And there were two cases in 2011 that raised concerns about the voluntary licensure program, and I know that Representative Greenlick had concerns prior to those cases, but that really brought things to a head. And what we heard really clearly from members of both the House and the Senate Health Committees was that you were wanting to move to a program of mandatory licensure and really wanted that to be studied. So we had this broad coalition work group that looked at this issue, and I think it was a really smart decision to include obstetricians, nurse midwives, and direct entry midwives in this because, as we know, out-of-hospital midwives inherently work in a system where we need to interact with nurse midwives and need to interact with obstetricians because some percentage of our clients are going to transfer care into the hospital system, and so we're working in coalition. And I think we've come to a pretty good consensus about the core issues that need to move forward in this bill. There are other issues and other concerns that I have or other members of the work group have or other people outside of the work group have that we're probably not going to be able to resolve in one legislative session. And I think it's going to be really imperative for you all to consider the progress that we can make and the progress that we can make without compromising the core areas of agreement. And the core areas of agreement are about beginning a program of mandatory licensure to ensure that all people who are providing this kind of sensitive care to women in Oregon are part of a system of accountability. And to restore the autonomy of the board, to bring it in line with other healthcare boards. this would mean that the people who are clinical experts in midwifery on the board, which the board includes not just licensed direct entry midwives, but an obstetrician and a nurse midwife, are the people who are making the decisions around what should be the repercussions in an investigation in a case where there's a finding, that those people with that clinical expertise are the people making rulemaking decisions. And the third area that there is consensus about, which although there's consensus about the general concept, but disagreement about the specifics, is that we would like to have an exemption for traditional midwives. There are enough communities in Oregon that have long-lasting traditions of midwifery or specific religious or cultural or philosophical concerns that we don't want to create a law that completely criminalizes these practices that we know are going to continue in our state. The areas that we haven't found full resolution are around what we know is one of the main barriers to licensure for unlicensed midwives, which is the cost of the license fee. We're such a small board. Currently there are 70 some odd licensed midwives, and even if we get to full licensure of all the midwives that I know of in the entire state, that would mean we would be not that much over 100 midwives total. And it's for the board to have to fully cover its own costs creates a really high licensure fee. So I'm hopeful that the committee can look at some of the models that have happened in other states where the state has offset the cost of running a board for small boards like that, even if it's just temporarily. I could say a whole lot more in detail, but I think maybe I'm just going to open it up to your questions, because I'm sure that you have specific questions or concerns, and I don't want to just ramble on about details if those aren't.
We'll also be dealing with this bill in regular committee too, so this is not over. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Just a comment. I think this constitutes remarkable progress.
Yes.
And as one who's dabbled in this and been bitten severely, so I think it's
enough said.
I will say one last comment. I just want to prepare you that I know that there will be opposition from some of the home birth and birth center community about this bill, and I just want the committee to be aware that there are a significant population in our state that feel really concerned about state control of birthing options when they feel like it's a personal choice, a familial choice, and I just want that to be out on the table.
This may come as a shock to you, but we deal with a lot of bills that have significant opposition. So. Not new.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I neglected to say that a part of our big conversation has been around informed consent and or informed refusal as well, that like the vaccination issue, we don't want to be in a position where the state is forcing people to do a certain thing, and yet we feel like the education component is critical. And so in whatever exemptions we do, we're looking very carefully at either informed consent or informed refusal. So,
Mr. Chair.
And it's a big balance between consumer access and consumer protection, because you might think you're protecting consumers, but if you're leaving some people to then deliver on their own because they feel like our system doesn't encompass them, we can actually make it more dangerous. So it's a big balance that we're trying to achieve.
I just want to comment, when we start discussing this again, we'll get the 400 letters that say we're trying to prevent home births, and I think we want to make very clear our objective is not to prevent home births, but to make sure they're as safe as we possibly can.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to amend what I said earlier. We're going to go to LC's right now, and John, you and Sean then will have. I'm being told we'll do this in 10 minutes, so.
I think we can do it in 10 minutes.
In 11 minutes, you guys have to stand up and get ready.
Yeah, you need to get ready.
She's got to see if she can talk as fast. I just want to comment. Traditionally, We have accepted any LCs for introduction as a committee bill. We intend to continue to do that. There, without accepting them for submission as a committee bill, doesn't isn't any comment on the merit of the bill, the contents, or anything else. It's just our, it's just been our tradition and the tradition of several other committees that we'll do that. And we're going to do that now. I'm going to ask Sandy to read the LC numbers and the relating to clause, and then I will accept a motion to move them in block. So it's only how fast she can read is the.
And you need to open a work session.
We open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills for pre-session filing.
LC 178 dated 10-12-12 relating to drug recognition evaluations. LC 180 dated 12-6-12 relating to driving while under the influence of intoxicants. LC 189 6-20-12 relating to driving while under the influence of intoxicant diversion agreements. LC 257 dated 7-23-12 relating to driving while under the influence of intoxicants. LC 799 relating to qualified health plans offered through the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange dated 7-17-12. LC 800 dated 7-18-12 relating to healthcare delivery. LC 816 dated 9-13-12 relating to licensees who self-refer to the impaired health professional program. LC 832, 7-25-12 relating to proof of treatment for substance abuse. LC 897, 8-8-12 relating to the transfer of 500 or more enrollees from one managed care organization to another managed care organization. LC 935, 12-4-12 relating to prescription drugs. LC 992, 10-5-12 relating to midwifery. LC 1534, 10-1-12 relating to health clubs. LC 1794, 10-1-12 relating to impaired health professional program. LC 2182, 11-28-12 relating to the confidentiality of pest control reports. LC 2252, 11-20-12 relating to enrollment and qualified health plans. LC 2280, 12-6-12 relating to standards for collection of demographic data. LC 2307, 10-23-12 relating to distribution of master settlement agreement funds. LC 2546, 11-1-12 relating to task force on educator health benefits. LC 2546, 11-1-12 relating to task force on educator health benefits. LC 2624, 11-27-12 relating to enrollment and qualified health plans. LC 2287, 11-19-12 relating to evidence-based health care. LC 947, 8-22-12 relating to impaired health professional program established by the Oregon Health Authority. LC 1525, 10-22-12 relating to health benefit plans for Oregon educators. LC 1403, 10-2-12 relating to increasing access to health care. LC 1404, 10-5-12, relating to determinations of responsibility for contractors on public improvement contracts. LC 2369, 11-27-12, relating to durable medical equipment.
Mr. Chair, you have a motion?
Well, if there was ever a point at which you should say ditto, this is it.
say ditto.
Chair Greenlee, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 178 dated 10-12-12, LC 180 dated 12-6-12, LC 189 dated 6-20-12, LC 257 dated 7-23-12, LC 799 dated 7-17-12, LC 800 dated 7-18-12, LC 816 dated 9-13-12, LC 832 dated 7-25-12, LC 897 dated 8-8-12, LC 935 dated 12-4-12, LC 992 dated 10-5-12, LC 1534 dated 10-1-12, LC 1794 dated 10-1-12, LC 2182 dated 11-28-12, LC 2252 dated 11-20-12, LC 2257 dated 11-19-12, LC 2280 dated 12-6-12, LC 2307 dated 10-23-12, LC 2546 dated 11-01-12, LC 2624 dated 11-27-12, LC 2287 dated 11-19-12, LC 947 dated 8-22-12, LC 1525 dated 10-22-12, LC 1403 dated 10-22-12, LC 1404 dated 10-5-12, and LC 2369 dated 11-27-12.
And
we Would you just mention again what you said? 2252?
Did you mention 2252 and 2546?
2252.
I think he did.
Yeah, 2250.
2252 is here.
Would you just read it again?
Okay, LC 2252, dated 11/2012.
And 2546.
And LC 2546, dated 11/1/12.
We have a motion on the floor. Any objections? So moved. Okay. Less than 10 minutes.
Great.
You have the gavel back.
I would also remind you again, this does not constitute approval of these bills out of committee action, and it certainly doesn't indicate approval on the floor. So this is the beginning of a process.
Really?
And with that, I would like to close today with a discussion of pharmacy benefits.
Yes, close your work session.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's right.
Go ahead.
We will close the work session relating to introduction of committee legislative concepts and reopen the meeting on pharmacy benefit management workshop, a work group report. And we have two very illustrious members of that team with us today, Sean Miller, Board Committee Pharmacy Council, and John Eames, Eames Consulting. And they both did a sterling job on a very contentious issue. I'm very pleased to have you here today.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Community Pharmacy Council, and I represent the pharmacy interests on the PBM work group or pharmacy benefit manager work group. And just to remind those not on the committee, the PBM is essentially that middleman that creates the pharmacy network. They're the one that designs, negotiates, and manages the prescription drug programs for most of your health care plans, whether it's an organization or even the state. Thanks, Representative Thompson, Representative Doherty, and Representative Bailey for serving and running that work group. We met several times throughout the summer and the fall to deal with several different issues evolving from House Bill 4122 from last session that started the discussion on PBMs, and essentially from the pharmacy community what we term as transparency issues. I think if you were to kind of put it all into one bucket, the issues that we dealt with, I think transparency was the main theme that we carried throughout the group and desire to look at. Of those issues, we looked at regulatory structures. We did research on a lot of other states, whether it's Board of Pharmacy participation, whether it's Insurance Division, DCPS participation. That's still an ongoing discussion. We looked at pharmacy audit practices for the PBM, which basically looking at what we believe now is a lack of standardization in those audit practices and coming up with what a lot of states are enacting, putting some standardization of how a PBM would audit a pharmacy and dealing with, again, clerical errors versus fraud, and we're defining those. And those are areas that I think we have at least some agreement to right now. We're going to continue to work through that. The other issues is what we call MAC pricing for generic drugs. That's maximum allowable cost, and I'll let Representative Thompson or Representative Doherty describe what that is, because that's very complicated. But we're still working through those issues. And then also mail order. So I think the four areas that we're continuing to work on, Sandy did a great job of at least on our initial draft 935 having comments contributed from all of the parties, which involve not only pharmacy interests, PBM, the health plans, as well as health authority, Board of Pharmacy participation. And we are in the process of going through here. Again, there was some agreement on suggestions, so we're trying to assemble that into a document that we have been asked to then meet with the PBM groups, the pharmacy interests, and we're also the health plan, and try to come up with some agreement on where we can and where we can't. It's obviously up to this committee to resolve those issues, and so we will do that. And just in conclusion, LC 935, which you just did enact or at least introduce for next session, is the vehicle. It's not, again, not done. We don't view that as the final product. It's a working product, and we will continue to meet through January and and try to get a product for this committee to work on next session. I appreciate the work group and your time. Thank you.
Representative Thompson, Representative Greenlick, members of the committee for the record, Jonathan Eames here from Eames Consulting here on behalf of, I actually represent CVS Caremark, but as the representative for the pharmacy benefits managers on the work group.
How many lobbyists were there involved?
There's a lot of lobbyists involved in this process.
I'm outnumbered.
But there were also stakeholders involved in the process too. You know, we had real live pharmacists on the committee, as well as folks who participate in mail order pharmacies were there, as well as Osberg and other stakeholders. So there was a wide group of folks that were participating, and frankly, it wasn't just me, because I am just a lobbyist, but there were folks who were actually from PBMs and from insurance companies who were allowed to participate and testify and that type of thing. So I think Sean gave a good overview of the issues that we're grappling with. We're committed to trying to work out as many of those as possible prior to coming to before you. I don't think we're going to get there on everything, but we're going to work on trying to resolve those in the short order in the next month or two prior to the legislative session, so we can at least get some agreement and shrink the decision points that you guys need to make. So thank you, Representative Thompson, Representative Doherty, and Representative Bailey for hosting and putting it together. And Sandy, because Sandy did a ton of work too.
Yeah. Well, I think just on a comment is that this was a very diverse group that came together with very diverse ideas and very complicated ideas for the people who don't deal with this every day. And really listening to the concerns, especially of rural Oregon and the rural pharmacies, and how they really are a mainstay in the community. So I appreciate what you guys getting together and hopefully getting the differences a little bit closer.
We may have another work group just on MAC pricing, until somebody understands it.
Right. Well, I'd also like to echo Sean's comment that this is a definite work in progress. So we're working on it.
This next session will end, though, so we need to have it timely manner. Yeah.
You mean the one on Friday? Or?
Yeah, right. We were thinking of amending it into the bill. Yeah.
Anything else for the good of the order?
Well, I think last
you don't change our work ended on time.
Yeah. This is my last meeting as co-chair. So I want to thank you people for your patience and understanding and your diligent work.
Thank you for your
You don't know what the future will hold, but...
Yeah, I can say it's my last meeting as co-chair as well.
That's right. Somehow or other, I'm not as sympathetic to you.
You'll be with us.
Hopefully, I will not be going away. I'll put it that way. And with that, the House Interim Committee on Healthcare is adjourned.